Okay, anything preliminary?
Yeah, he has nominal debt.
I haven't done a grade spread. Again, I think the average was a 2.7.
No, I mean any of this kind of like.
Oh, any? No. Oh, no, no, any economics? No, the yeah, the purpose of giving you Posner's analysis in O'Shea is not that I want to turn you into you know, if I'm sure many of you were saying if I'd wanted to wear a green eye shade, I would have stayed in accounting school. Or, but part of it is just to introduce you to this very significant school of thought, so-called law and economics. And Posner's probably the dean, or at least one of the leading figures in this school of economics, law and economics, Richard Epstein, Frank Easterbrook, starting with George Stigler, and the whole Chicago School of Economics has sort of been the nerve center of that. And they've had a fairly significant impact on thinking about the law. One of the phenomena is that we sort of lack a unified theory of law. You know, what is law? Why is there law? What is sort of the guiding principle? And to the extent that law and economics supplies an explanation, law is about efficiency. It's had an impact. But the actual mechanics of working out the discount rate and that sort of thing is obviously beyond the scope of the kind of thing that you'd be doing in your office in a preliminary way evaluating a case. And let's talk more about that when we get there. Our task this morning is first to finish off Chapter 2 and then to work our way through Chapter 3. Anything preliminary? Okay. Well, I left you yesterday with the sort of the problem of Kinsman Transit. Here you've got this case in which a rather unusual set of coincidences, if you will, a series of negligent acts combined to produce this gigantic flood and consequent destruction. And the question is, on what basis do you decide how much these defendants have to pay? And it's probably not here anymore. It's not here anymore. But remember, you've got the two major defendants, the owner of the dock. That's one defendant. The other defendant is the city of Buffalo that owns the bridge. Each of them was negligent. The people at the dock were negligent in failing to tie this boat up adequately. And the people operating the bridge were negligent in not having somebody there to raise the bridge when actually two different vessels out of control should have been allowed to pass through the bridge and instead got jammed up against it, caused a flood, a collapse of the bridge and so forth. Okay, so the first question is, what we're trying to do is contrast how Cardozo would ask and answer this question about the extent of liability and the way in which Andrews would ask and answer the question about liability. So, can somebody take a... First, let's talk about Cardozo. How would Cardozo evaluate the question of the extent of liability for these folks? Ms. Reed? Okay, let's start with the people at Continental Dock. They would be liable. Okay, and we would, in order to answer that question, we would ask what? How far does the breach of, how far is the duty owed, according to Cardozo? Well, I mean, that would be the easy part if somebody right over here had a dock, let's say, or a boat tied up at the dock, and this boat smashes into it and causes damage. Everybody, including Cardozo, would agree there's liability for that. Why? Why do we know that that there was a duty owed to these people and that duty was breached? Yes, it's the as far as the eye of reasonable vigilance would perceive a danger. And certainly, from Cardozo's perspective, we place ourselves in the shoes of the person on this cold, you know, January day, securing this boat, and we sort of freeze frame the action at that point, have a little, you know, bubble, cartoon bubble above their head, and follow the thought process, gee, I wonder what could happen if I mess this up. What would the eye of reasonable vigilance perceive as this zone of danger, the scope within which people are in peril if I mess this up? And again, it's easy to say, well, yeah, if this boat gets loose and floats not so gently down the stream, bashes into something, people along property are going to get hurt. What about somebody upstream? Not downstream, but upstream. Would they be within the zone of danger? No, because presumably a person exercising reasonable vigilance, freeze-framing this moment at which they're securing this boat, you say, well, what bad thing could happen? Bad things could happen downstream, but it's pretty difficult to see how it is that somebody upstream would be put in peril by what I'm doing. Now, if I think about it long enough, maybe there's somebody over here with a huge barge full of liquefied natural gas that's going to blow up and create a 3-mile-wide swath of destruction. But that's not particularly... Again, the Cardozian perspective depends on how long you give people to think about the possible consequences. If you're making a list and you've got 3 hours to think of all the things that possibly might happen, you can come up with just about anything. But, again, the standard is that of reasonable vigilance. Could a person reasonably foresee this kind of injury? Now, as it turns out, there's some reference to the fact that periodically they would dynamite ice chunks or you know, these sort of little mini icebergs or blocks of ice moving down the river in a cold winter environment where there's ice in the river and it forms and it breaks up and it's kind of sometimes they would have to go out and dynamite these things to prevent an ice dam from forming naturally. Now, again, if you had long enough to think about it, a person tying up this boat might think, well, gee, if I let it go and it gets into this mix of things, it might be part of forming an ice dam. And then the flooding victims back here would be reasonably foreseeable. Again, it's not that if I know it's a Cardozo jurisdiction, gee, the defendant's going to win. It is, Cardozo asks a different kind of question, you go through a different analysis. Let's try it now for the city of Buffalo. Is it for the guy sitting in the tavern, we freeze frame him, you know, mug of beer halfway to his lips, you know, looking at the TV screen saying, can I get watch the end of this hockey game, or do I need to scurry back to make sure I'm there at the shift change? You know, what bad thing can happen if I'm not there? Well, it'll probably be some people just coming down the river at that point. They're honking their horns or calling on the radio to say, raise the bridge, and there's nobody there. And they've got to cool their jets waiting for me to get there and raise the bridge, and maybe they'll complain to my supervisor and so forth. Maybe even there's going to be a vessel that has lost power and can't sit there waiting for it, and it's going to bash up against the bridge, causing damage to the vessel, causing damage to the bridge. Yes, bad things could happen if I don't get there in time. Again, in the Cardozian world, you freeze frame the action for the defendant and ask the question, what could a person reasonably foresee? We have the advantage of 20/20 hindsight, knowing what did happen, but we, for purposes of this exercise, ask the question, what in real time would a reasonable person foresee as the consequences, potential consequences of their negligence? Would it be reasonably foreseeable to the guy sitting in the tavern that if he doesn't get back in time, there's going to be a flood? Again, the question is, you know, how big a danger is flooding if in fact they periodically dynamite these blocks of ice, then the danger of flooding is not all that crazy a thought. It would take some doing for not just one vessel, but two vessels to wedge themselves in and create this dam that together with the ice causes a flood. But maybe that's not beyond the eye of reasonable vigilance. Maybe that's just why we want people constantly available at the bridge controls, because such things are foreseeable and when they happen are catastrophic. So maybe from a Cardozian world, it is foreseeable, but maybe it's not. Again, the question that's asked is, could a person in the defendant's position reasonably foresee this kind of consequence? If they could, there is a duty owed. If they couldn't reasonably foresee it, there is no duty owed. Mr. Lynch. Actually, that's a question for the judge, because the question about the scope of a legal duty has been thought to be a question of law. It's not was the light red, was the light green, you know, who was speeding, who jumped the light. It's not so much a question about factual analysis, it's a question about what is the scope of legal liability. So, again, this is why Paul's graph is the contrast of philosophies and the contrast of sociology. Cardozo is keeping the decision about the scope of liability in the judge's hands, because it is a question of law about the scope of duty. Now, let's switch to the Andrews perspective. From Andrews' perspective, what is the question we ought to ask? Anderson.
I think Andrews would ask, was the actions of the person who docked the boat responsible for the big calamity that came down the river?
And when you say responsible, what do we mean?
Negligence.
Well, but Andrews thinks the question is not so much about negligence. He thinks it's a question, Ms. Peterson?
About proximate cause.
Yeah, yeah. I think your question about being responsible is essentially the question, should they be held responsible? But from Andrew's perspective, the negligence part is easy. We could establish, okay, according to industry custom, et cetera, when you have a vessel of this size, you use these kinds of procedures and this sort of equipment to, you know, in this kind of weather, et cetera, you can establish what they did was substandard. It was negligent. But Andrew says, even if they're negligent, the limit to legal liability is set by the standard of proximate cause. As you reach consequences for which you cannot say the negligent act was a proximate cause, you say, no more liability. For example, if there were I think they used the example of a physician who, because the bridge is down, can't get, in the days when physicians still need house calls, that the physician can't get to the appointments and loses the revenue that would have been earned had the bridge not negligently been destroyed. As to them, you know, Andrew says, or at least the standard would be, those people don't have a claim. Yes, but for the negligent act of the defendant, they would have gotten this revenue, but it's not something we can say was proximately caused by the defendant's negligence. What about the bridge owners the bridge operators allowing this thing to fail and flood everything? Is that something for which the city ought to be liable, according to Andrews? What criteria do we use in establishing what and what is not a proximate cause, Mr. Ortiz? Okay. Why?
There is a possibility that it may flood, it may come back up, but if there was a possibility to raise that bridge,
okay. You could build an argument based upon foreseeability, but the court also takes into account, the majority of the court takes into account the fact that the city of Buffalo can easily spread the cost of this accident to the taxpayers of the city of Buffalo. They've got the wherewithal to act sort of as, you know, going back to Bierman versus the city of New York, they can spread the loss. For the majority of the court, it seems like good public policy that they pay rather than the flooding victims be told, in effect, I'm sorry, your loss would not have occurred but for the negligence of the city, but we can't say it was a legal cause of your injury and therefore you can't recover. The court says it's better to say to them, yes, you can recover, and the city of Buffalo will raise the money for your compensation by raising taxes. Now, Judge Moore in dissent has a problem with that. It sort of goes back to, you know, Helling versus Carey looking out in the parking lot and looking, you know, searching for who has the shinier car. The one with the late model car pays and the one with the rundown car doesn't pay. Well, in effect, the city of Buffalo is made to pay here because they've got the scratch. And you know, Judge Moore says that's kind of a yucky thing for us to, well, at least to be admitting here. I mean, it wouldn't shock me that sort of goes in people's thinking process, but to have this said explicitly by the majority of the court is troubling. But the majority, following Andrews, is unapologetic about that and says, in effect, we are invited through this standard to use our common sense, to try to make practical judgments. Leave the theory to one side, make judgments that will, in the experience of average everyday people, make sense. And if the city of Buffalo's got it, well, then they should pay it. After all, they were negligent. Their negligence is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. Why not? Now, again, this is interesting stuff from the standpoint of again, asking, as I said at the outset with respect to Judge Posner, well, what are we expecting of the legal system? What are the principles on which the legal system is founded? What are the limits of liability? Is somebody's wealth a proper basis upon which to say, you pay, but somebody else won't have to pay? And for some people, that seems perfectly logical, and for other people, it's outrageous. And again, that's why it makes it interesting. For our purposes here, not only do I want to sort of invite you to think about these things, ask yourself the question, what do I believe about these issues? But for purposes of the exam and for purposes of helping you become more effective lawyers, what you want to do is be able to recognize, I've gotten into one of those areas for which there is no technical answer. It's not, you know, figuring out the priority of creditors in a bankruptcy proceeding where I match up this clause of, you know, this section of the Uniform Commercial Code with that one. It's a point at which we've reached a policy decision. And depending upon who gets to make the policy decision, it may go one way or it may go another. Okay, questions about Kinsman Transit, about the difference between Cardozo and Andrews. I tend to get answers to questions on the midterm where people say, if this is a Cardozo jurisdiction, the defendant will win. On the other hand, if it's an Andrews jurisdiction, the plaintiff will win. And as I've tried to say, it's not that simple. Even using a Cardozo form of analysis, defendants can still be held liable if the judge winds up thinking this is something a reasonable person could have foreseen. And even in an Andrews jurisdiction, someone can say, yeah, it caused it, but it's not a proximate cause. So, on the other hand, I think you could say that Cardozo's method is more defendant-friendly. If you're a defendant, you'd rather have a Cardozo-type jurisdiction. And if you're a plaintiff, you'd rather have an Andrews jurisdiction where it's thrown to the jury and they get to roll it around. No guarantee of success, but at least you've got the question in the hands of the jury. I gave you one example in the superseding cause area, the rat poison case. There's another example that I meant to give you and didn't, and I'll give it to you now. It's the exam I used, I believe, in the fall of 2002, so the most recent first semester exam that I gave, taken from a real case. Some kids go to a convenience store. The kid is 17, purchases cigarettes in violation of a statute prohibiting the sale of tobacco products to minors. Kid goes off to with his pals to find a place where they can smoke these unobserved. They find a pile of logs and perch themselves on the logs, light up, and one of them drops a cigarette, burning cigarette. They try to, you know, sort of find it or put it out or whatever, and can't figure out how to do that, leave it there, and eventually this starts the log pile on fire. And I, that part of it is from the case. And the real plaintiff was the owner of the log pile. I added a situation where firefighters come to rescue the logs, or to put out the fire. The log pile collapses, and one of the firefighters is killed by the collapsing pile of logs. So the question is, what's the the exam question was, what's the liability of the convenience store? Now, again, part of what you have to do is figure out if the convenience store sells tobacco to the 17-year-old, but that negligence winds up injuring the firefighter and the owner of the log pile, if you're the defendant, what arguments do you raise to avoid liability? Wasn't foreseeable. You could say that the actions of the 17-year-old were a superseding cause. Their criminal act of smoking was not foreseeable to the convenience store, the collapse of the law. You could also argue a sort of Paul's graph defense to say that from the defendant's perspective, the subsequent injuries were not reasonably, either it's a Cardozo jurisdiction, you say it's not reasonably foreseeable, these people were not within the zone of danger, that a person at the convenience store looking at this somewhat youthful customer wondering, gee, I wonder if it's, if he's 18, what bad things could happen if I sell to an underage minor, or to a minor? I repeat myself there. Would it be, would such a person reasonably foresee, you know, because minors can't legally smoke, they may go off into some secretive place and start a fire? Also, going back to the rat poison issue about what's the relevance of the statute, you would want to know where does the statute, or what light does the statute shed upon the question of the scope of the duty or the scope of proximate cause. Again, Cardozo wants to know how extensive is the scope of duty. Andrews wants to know what consequences can we say were proximately caused by this negligent behavior of selling cigarettes to a minor. The statute says, in effect, thou shalt not sell cigarettes to someone below the age of 18. And here are the penalties that you face if you do that. Does the statutory prohibition tell us anything about the scope of liability? What would you want to know about the statute? Ms. Reed? Yeah. And what's your guess as to the purpose of the statute? Right. Yeah. And in fact, one observant student noted that as I copied the statute from the from Westlaw and pasted it into my exam, the section in which this appears is under health and morals, something like that. So that, again, it's a strong argument for the defendant that the statutory purpose did not include fire damage from underage smokers carelessly using tobacco products. The fact that the prohibition extends to chewing tobacco, where there's no fire danger involved, unless you're chewing really fast, Again, you would make the argument as the defendant, no statutory connection here. So unlike the car thief case where we infer from the statute a purpose to prevent accidents like this, which is relevant not only to the negligence issue, but it's also relevant to the causation issue, showing that the legislature foresaw this kind of injury, therefore the defendant should have foreseen it. Again, and the way the case turns out, I think the trial judge initially allowed a negligence per se claim against the convenience store to hold the to allow the log pile owner to recover. And the Court of Appeals said, no, statutory purpose isn't met here. Statutory purpose was limited to protecting health and morals. This is essentially a random occurrence. And they also, as I recall, said, moreover, sort of in the pulse graph vein, this is not a foreseeable consequence of sale to underage customers. Provide. With respect to the firefighter's injuries are a result, arguably, of the negligence of the log pile owner as well as the negligence of the, it may indeed be the negligence of the firefighter that they're not putting out this fire according to standard, you know, procedures to avoid injuries like this. But one of the things you want to be careful of in this first semester exam is that you're not looking at contributory negligence and you're not looking at comparative negligence. We're looking for a proximate cause. So the scope of your task in analyzing a first semester problem is, can a defendant be held liable? To what extent? With what other co-defendants? With what offsets for the plaintiff's own negligence, etc., we don't yet address. The question is, can the injured parties here recover from the defendant? And the court's ultimate answer was no. There is no liability for that, for the convenience store. Sometimes modern statutes tend to say, you know, in order to preserve the environment for future generations and, and so that I can, you know, get votes from this constituency, you know, we hereby announce the whatever it is. You know, there's a lot of frou-frou in modern statutes. But older statutes often just, they're bare bones. This is legal, this is illegal, and you're left to, kind of exercise in the same way a judge would exercise judgment about, well, what is the purpose? Where is this, again, the observant student who recognized, well, look at where this is found. Is it found within the fire safety code? That would tell you a lot about its statutory purpose as distinguished from, you know, health and morals alongside, you know, other sorts of health measures. So, again, judges have to do the same process of taking a bare statute and making an educated judgment about what its purpose was. Sometimes you have the benefit of legislative history so that you have the statements. In fact, one of the chief occupations of the Supreme Court or other courts of appeals is in difficult cases of statutory interpretation. Here's a statute, what does it mean? Or for that matter, a provision of the Constitution. What does the First Amendment mean? We go back in many cases to look at the notes or the transcript of the debates in which the legislation or the amendment was proposed, what was being said about it in terms of the purpose it supposedly served, what objections were raised as to its scope or what amendments were made, and what does that tell us about its purpose? This whole process of statutory interpretation, the use of so-called legislative history, committee reports, etc., these things are sort of an arcane area of their own.
So when we're looking at these ordinances and statutes, we're going for if we're looking for the scope of liability, would we be able to use that under superseding actions as well as remote and indirect results, or
well,
would it be focused more on one area?
In the cigarette case, the advantage, the entree for a superseding cause is in fact that you're looking at a criminal act by minors. They go and actually trespass on this property, sit on the logs, and smoke their cigarettes. It's not like the guy who takes rat poison to murder his wife. It's, again, the relative culpability is such that it's not a particularly strong argument for a superseding cause. But on the other hand, the question of foreseeability. How foreseeable is it that if you sell cigarettes to minors, they're going to go off into some secluded place and drop the cigarettes in a place? They're not going to sit around their living room with an ashtray. They're more likely to do it in some place where the danger of fire presents itself. But you'd still say that the chain of causation. The idea of a superseding cause is there's essentially one, sort of 600-pound gorilla who is the focal point, the elephant in the living room. You've got one big, huge actor here, the guy who murders his wife with rat poison. That's what this is all about. I sold the rat poison? Well, whoop-de-doo. I'm just a bit player in this. You should be focusing on this one over here. So the idea of superseding causes, there is this sort of, elephant in the living room or 600-pound gorilla that ought to be the focal point of the action, and forget about me. Holzgraf, by contrast, is not about a single focal point. It's about a bunch of little cumulative chances that accumulate, and the action keeps twisting and turning, floating down the Buffalo River until it eventually erupts into this catastrophe. So it's not there is a superseding cause here. It's a series of unexpected twists and turns in the story, such that you say, from the time of the defendant's negligence until the plaintiff's injury, there is not this direct and continuous sequence of events. It's the chain of causation has sort of petered out. Again, these sort of metaphors that you drop a pebble in the water, and for a while you can see these rings of waves coming out from where at some point that is overtaken by other pebbles being dropped in the water. The impact of this initial thing eventually dissipates. So you have the same image of, somebody does something and that leads to something else and it leads to something else, but for legal purposes you can't say that something is a cause of another thing unless the connection remains relatively distinct. And at the point where it sort of blends in with the other causes out there, we say legal cause no longer exists. Again, sort of a judgment call to be made. Let's look at this last case of Harris. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because it's really a rather surprising case. And I include it mostly to illustrate the fact that courts don't always follow a nice, clear, bright line. Just to sort of speed this up here, The defendant in the case is a contractor who puts heavy construction debris into a dumpster. The plaintiff comes along and is trying to empty the dumpster, otherwise work with it. I forget what the plaintiff's doing there. And the dumpster tips over and injures the plaintiff. So the plaintiff sues the defendant, the contractor, and says, you were negligent in putting these large, this large debris, cement blocks or something, into the dumpster. That was a, you should have foreseen the imbalance you would be creating and the risk to people like me working subsequently to empty these dumpsters. Contractor says, oh no, as to you, or you as to me, are unforeseeable. I don't owe you a duty. I couldn't reasonably foresee an injury to you. And the trial court says, you're right, defendant. I'll give you summary judgment. And the plaintiff says, well, wait a minute. Why is this so difficult to foresee? And appeals it. And indeed, on appeal, the Court of Appeals reverses the trial court and says, you are a foreseeable plaintiff. The contractor's duty does run to you. Now, the logical place where you would think this would wind up is, suppose the defendant puts the stuff in the dumpster. The dumpster is then transported someplace else. Suppose, for example, you put hazardous chemicals in or some other kind of hazard. And it's carried off to a, you know, landfill or whatever, and somebody at the landfill gets injured. Then you would have at least a plausible kind of Paul's graph argument. With my front end loader poised over the dumpster, thinking to myself, gee, maybe it's not such a good idea to put all the heavy stuff at the top where it's likely to tip over. Again, freeze framing the operation as the, you know, hydraulic pumps are whining away and that, you know, bucket is about to tip. We freeze frame the action and say, what bad things could happen? You could certainly imagine a train of events at some point where this action would say no longer a foreseeable consequence. But the strange thing in this case is that the plaintiff is working right around the dumpster, the very scene of where these of where the injury is likely to take place. Now, maybe the defendant was negligent, maybe the defendant wasn't negligent, but it doesn't seem reasonable to say that this is an unforeseeable consequence and that the defendant is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Yet that's what the trial judge did. So most of the time I try to give you opinions that rightly or wrongly sort of reflect the, you know, this is the current state of the art. Here's an opinion in which the appellate court is simply cleaning up after a fairly, you know, significant lapse by the trial judge. But it's also to sort of illustrate to you the way in which, gee, if I'm the defendant in this case, I make arguments. I wouldn't think that the Paul's graph argument would work here. Gee, it turned out it did. Again, sort of by way of saying, sometimes you can be too smart for your own good, eliminating possibilities when, in fact, it's more sort of open texture. If you're the defendant and you make the Paul's graph argument and you win, you're in a much better position to negotiate a favorable settlement with the plaintiff who now has to go appeal it, get the judgment reversed, go back and try it again, than if you're at the trial court without that sort of advantage. So again, in a way, I sort of have misgivings about giving you this case. But again, on page 73, you have the dissenting opinion here, where the dissenting judge still thinks that the defendant, in putting this stuff in the dumpster, didn't owe a duty of care. Again, I find this sort of hard to fathom. I mean, you can say that the behavior was reasonable, but to say that you don't owe a duty of care by throwing stuff, I mean, maybe the principle is, as a matter of policy, people who put things in dumpsters shouldn't be responsible for subsequent harm. Sort of a free, you know, free dumping zone. But even that doesn't sound like very sensible public policy. So, again, such as it is, that's the Harris case. Here.
Didn't the dissenting opinion also try to shift the blame to the manufacturer of the dumpster itself by claiming that it was a product liability issue and that the dumpster was just defective?
Well, again, for purposes of deciding how the blame should be allocated, I would certainly concur with the idea that the plaintiff would be welcome to establish, or the defendant would be welcome to establish, that the dumpster was made defectively and that the manufacturer should bear the lion's share of this judgment. Again, though, the basis for the summary judgment was not so much that the contractor's behavior was reasonable, not that it was you know, that a reasonable person would expect, no matter what I put in this dumpster, they're designed to be made so that they won't tip over, and I shouldn't waste any time worrying about how I put this stuff in. The basis for the decision was you couldn't foresee injury to people working around the dumpster, and therefore you owed them, not that you weren't negligent, not that you didn't breach the duty of reasonable care, but that you didn't owe a duty of reasonable care. And that again, strikes the majority, and it strikes me as being kind of a, you know, dumb idea. But again, in recognition of the fact that as much as we try to make all of these cases fit together in one nice, coherent, rational, sensible whole, every once in a while you get these, or maybe not so infrequently, you get these deviations from the standards that we have set, and so be it. All right, let me see if I can summarize chapter 2 for you, and then we'll take a break and come back and look at chapter 3. Again, chapter 2 is the connecting link between establishing the defendant's some kind of wrongful conduct that we established in chapter 1, some breach of duty, negligence, strict liability, what have you. That determination, in effect, stands on its own. And between chapter 1 and chapter 3, the computation of the plaintiff's damages, we have this connecting link, chapter 2. And the standard that we impose is that in order for a plaintiff to recover, the plaintiff has to show that this breach of duty in chapter 1 proximately caused the damages in chapter 3. Now, that concept of proximate cause is in turn subdivided into two different questions. The first question is whether the defendant's negligence is a so-called but-for cause. Is it a cause without which the injury would not have occurred? Sometimes that's a no-brainer. But for the defendant failing to stop at the red light, there would have been no collision in the intersection. Other times, the question is much more difficult. What is the effect of the defendants exposing the plaintiff to hazardous chemicals? Was that a cause without which the plaintiff's leukemia would not have occurred? We need scientific data, we need expert opinion, we need to really scratch our heads to try to figure out what the relationship is. In addition to those sort of factual questions, we have circumstances in which the plaintiff wants relief from the traditional test in three different situations. The first kind of relief is the plaintiff says, I can't identify which of several defendants caused my injury. And so we walk through these different exceptions, alternative liability, concert of action, enterprise liability, market share liability, and we spent time sort of differentiating which exception applies under which kind of case. But again, that's a way of solving the problem that the plaintiff can't identify which defendant caused the plaintiff's injury. If the plaintiff qualifies for one of those exceptions, we'll use a modified test in place of the traditional but-for test. The second exception comes when the plaintiff has been harmed, but the defendant says, even under the best of circumstances, even if I had used reasonable care, you didn't have a better than even chance of recovering. And the typical case in which this exception is applied is medical malpractice. So the plaintiff's already more than likely going to suffer, let's say, fatal consequences from a heart attack, but the defendant's negligence takes away the sizable chance, maybe a 30% or 40% chance, that that injury could have been avoided. In those cases, in medical malpractice, the courts will apply this loss of a chance theory, where you can get the value of that chance. They're treating it like a lottery ticket. What's the payoff if you win, discounted by the probability that your ticket will turn out to be a winning ticket. The third exception we had to the traditional but-for test was multiple redundant causes, as in asbestos exposure or alcohol consumption at a variety of different places. Where the plaintiff would have difficulty showing that any defendant was a cause without which the injury would not have occurred, because the combination of the defendant's actions combined together to produce the injury, and they overlapped in such a way that no single defendant's conduct can be said to have made a difference. If these are multiple redundant causes, the courts will substitute the substantial factor test in place of a traditional but-for test. Okay, that's all with respect to the but-for question. The second prong of proximate cause is legal cause, which is not so much a factual question, what did or did not happen. It's a question about public policy. Is it fair? Is it appropriate? Is it desirable that defendants who do this kind of thing should be made to pay for this kind of injury? And there are three circumstances in which we will say, yes, it was a but-for cause, but not a legal cause. The first kind of case is where there's a mere chance relationship. So that, yes, the defendant's negligence turned out to trigger this consequence, but there's no relationship such that the defendant's negligence increased the risk of the plaintiff's injury. The defendant was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Berry versus Sugarnut. The second exception or application of this legal cause principle is through superseding causes. You've got a car thief or a rapist or a murderer whose action seizes upon the defendant's negligence by providing an inadequately lit parking lot, or poor security in a hotel, or over-serving the the defendant over serving a driver with alcohol or supplying a murder weapon to the murderer. In those cases, can we say that the defendant's negligence caused the plaintiff's injury? Did the sale of rat poison cause this guy to commit murder? Well, no. I mean, there's something about that that we say, wait a minute, that sort of dismisses casts doubt upon the criminal conviction of this guy for murder. He was convicted of murder because he committed a free act, because nobody forced him, you know, nobody caused him to commit this murder except the malice in his own heart. So again, a superseding cause is one which is so unforeseeable and so disproportionate in its culpability that we can't really say of the defendant's negligence, although it facilitated, made possible the theft of the car or the assault in the parking lot. We can't say it caused it, and therefore there's no liability for the defendant, although we recognize it's a but-for cause, and it was negligent. The third application of legal cause are these cases in which the twists and turns of the event are so coincidental, so fortuitous, that we say, gee, the scope of liability doesn't extend that far. Either by using Cardozo's analysis of the scope of the duty of care, or by using Andrew's limitation on proximate cause, we arrive at a conclusion that the defendant's negligence could be fairly attributed as a cause of these consequences, but by the time the events twisted and turned to this point, the chain of causation ran out, or the scope of duty doesn't extend that far. That's chapter 2. Why don't we take a break, and we'll come back and start on chapter 3.